Hello, world. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Our website is pcradioshow.org. The Personal Computer Show may be heard each Wednesday on prn.fm on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and on WBAI 99.5 FM New York on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. We live stream the WBAI broadcast on WBAI.org. Some quick headline news in the computer industry. Mac and Windows Skype users are given until March 1st to modernize themselves with the latest version of Skype. As posted late last week, Redmond's new plan will mean that come March 1st, users of Skype for Windows Desktop 7.16 and below, or Skype for Mac 7.0 to 7.18, will no longer be able to sign in after March 1st with the old version. To avoid that, you need merely update your Skype client before the due date. The change is necessary, Microsoft says, because the client mentioned above were built for the old Skype peer-to-peer architecture, and Skype is now heading to the cloud architecture, the better to allow services like file sharing from within the Skype client and mobile video chats. Also, by March 1st, the FBI won't let you email in Freedom of Information Act requests. You can only send them by fax, snail mail, or their internal submission portal. Formal requests citing the Freedom of Information Act have been a powerful tool in the public's effort to legally get information from the government, not just for yourself, but once the Freedom of Information Act's request runs its lengthy course, an official body often releases that intel publicly. Well, that will now change. This will undoubtedly hinder public ability to get information from the agency. Microsoft is retiring Windows Vista on April 11th, ending all support for that operating system. After Vista's retirement from support, the next edition on the out-to-pasture list will be Windows 7, which is slated to receive its last security update on January 14th, 2020. The primary function of a cell phone is the ability to send and receive telephone calls between you and the people you need to contact. It may also be in text mode. If the coverage is not there, then all other functions and features of the cell phone is, well, meaningless. All things being equal, the quality of service is the next important factor. There is a website, opensignal.com, that's OpenSignal.com, which enables you to determine if the coverage of the carrier meets your needs. The information is based on basic point-to-point information and does not necessarily account for any obstruction that may hinder the signal. For most people living in urban centers, the coverage of all four major carriers, that's Verizon, T-Mobile, AT&T, and Sprint, will meet your calling requirements. In the December 2016 issue of Computer World, they published an article titled, "The Votes Are In, Which Mobile Data Provider Is Best?" And if you do a search with the following four words, Computer World, Quality of Carriers, you may be able to access that article, and the URL is quite lengthy, so I won't go into it. Verizon made headlines recently when it announced a new unlimited data plan, a coveted option for those who don't want to worry about overage fees. But how does the Verizon plan compare to Sprint, AT&T, and T-Mobile's unlimited options? Well, let's take a look at it, and let's find out what the catches are. The big four carriers offer unlimited plans with unlimited talk, texting, and data. And that comes with a catch, though. When you hit that data limit, even though they call it the unlimited plan, your data speeds are slowed down, and that's called throttling, as your data needs are sent to the back of the line. There are data limits for each carrier. AT&T upper limit before they start throttling is 22 gigabytes. Sprint is 23 gigabytes. T-Mobile has the highest before they throttle, and that's 28 gigabytes. Verizon is 22 gigabytes. That is called throttling. This refers to data usage or overusage, and data throttling is what happens when you blow through too much data, so your provider slows you down and your network speed. Sadly, data throttling has become a common practice for cell phone service providers who aim to limit data usage on their networks and combat congestion while still flying the flag saying they have an unlimited data plan. Let's look at each one. ATT, well, $100 for the first line. However, you need to have DirecTV or UVerse service, which is TV service, so that the total cost for that one line is $150 a month. And for each additional line, it's $40 a month. Single users would then be $150, two users, $190, three users, $230, and four users, $270. Of course, this includes TV. Note that ATT expense includes the service. Sprint, $55 a month. And it's $5 less if you have the auto pay discount. In other words, if you prepay, you get a discount of $5, so let's call it $50. $40 a month for the second line, and $30 for lines 3 through 5. So that makes it single user is $50, of course, with the prepaid plan. Two users, $90. Three users, $120. And four users for $150. Then there's T-Mobile. T-Mobile One is $70, and there's a $5 prepaid discount for one user, $100 a month for the first two lines, or $47 per month for each of three lines, or $40 each for four lines. So what does that work out to? Single user with a discount, $65. Two users, $100. Three users, $141. And four users, $160. Verizon is basically $80 a month, and of course, they too have a prepaid discount of $5. It's $45 a month for each additional line. So for a single user, it's $75, two users, $120, three users for $165, and four users, $210. Obviously, one of the reasons unlimited plans exist are to offer lots of data at reasonable prices, at least reasonable enough to beat the overage charges. And with some of these carriers, they may have some hidden other charges that I've been not able to ferret out. Well, the iPhone 7s are being delivered, and one of Apple's newest iPhones is, well, they're having problems. And this is due to lack of quality. And I think Apple should worry about it. Apple users have found that the matte black model of the iPhone 7 is prone to easy chipping off. In other words, the color or whatever the chip is, it chips off even when you have a protective case on it. And one of the users saying that he's been using the iPhone 7 matte black for about a month and is fully covered with a case with tempered glass, and it still happens. He says, I just open the casing once a week to wipe the dust off from the phone. And until yesterday, when I take off the casing and notice there's something at the edge of the phone body next to the up volume button. At first, I thought it was just dust. I try to wipe it using microfiber cloth as usual. Until I look closely at it and the metal part of the body, it seems that the black anodized paint has been chipped off from the phone body. Other iPhone users are having similar experience. A bunch of photos have been posted to Apple on their forum to show how bad the problem is. Hey, Apple, you better get to it because Samsung's Galaxy 8 is coming out. You had a free month of being able to make deliveries on the iPhone 7 because of Samsung's problem. Well, competition is coming back. And I hope that Apple can find out what the problem is and make good with those users who already have perceived damage to their phone in terms of cosmetics. China has announced that they have a new supercomputer called the Sunway Tilight, and it's the fastest computer in the world. How fast is it? It can do 125 petaflops. It has 10,649,600 CPU cores and 131 petaflops of primary memory. That's not just big. It's big like a mountain big, Jupiter big. China claims zero of the top 500 supercomputers in the world 15 years ago. Today, it not only has more than everyone else, including the United States, but its best machine boasts speeds 5 times faster than the best the U.S. can muster. And in a first, it achieved those speeds with purely China-made chips. Now, let me tell you, this is all parallel processing. Unless you have a program that is capable and requires parallel processing, you're not going to go any faster than what the fastest single core can run. So having 10 million of them, to be more exact, 10,649,600 cores, unless the problem that you're solving can be broken down into that many units, you're not going to go any faster. We need a new breakthrough to be able to run a single task. In a research report by Goldman Sachs, it estimated that 900,000 to a million H-1B visa holders now reside in the United States, and they account for 13% of the American technology jobs. In 2014, 13 outsourcing firms accounted for one-third of all H-1B visas. They use a loophole in the current first-come-first-serve lottery system to flood the applicant pool with their candidates. In many cases, those candidates are paid slightly more than $60,000 a year minimum salary required by the program for dependent companies seeking a waiver for having to recruit Americans first, but less than what American technology workers make. Unfortunately, it has been abused, and many of the people who have been replaced by H-1B workers now have to train the people that are replacing them in order to qualify for severance pay. Like any other program, with the H-1B program, it started off with the right motivation, which is to hire technical skills which are not available in the United States, but then now we have replaced many of the American workers with the technical skills to train those who can make less money coming in from overseas. There was a problem for H-1B workers. They would be coming over here from overseas to work, and many of them had spouses actually to live with them. And when they come over here, they had no work. So what the Obama administration did was made available and said, okay, since you're here and your spouse is working, you too qualify to work here. About 180,000 of them are here, but they qualify as spouses of people working as H-1B workers. 2017 camera shipment forecast from the CIPA is expected to decline by 10.3%. CIPA is the Camera and Imaging Products Association, and they had projected that for the year 2017, about 22 million units would be delivered on a year-to-year basis, which represents a decline of 10.3%, and the number of shipment of digital cameras with built-in lens are projected to be about 10.5 million, or about half of that total amount. Shipment of digital cameras with interchangeable lens represent the other half, and that is expected to decline by 3.4%. And they expect that the interchangeable lens for these cameras will be about flat. So what they're saying is that digital cameras with interchangeable lens will probably remain flat in terms of delivery. Last year, Nikon announced a new line of cameras built on the 1-inch sensor. These three cameras were well-designed. They looked great. The specs were really fantastic. Aperture was f1.8 wide open to 2.8. That's quite good. Seemed like a well-designed camera. However, Nikon has decided to kill the entire DL line of cameras without selling a single one of them. What a shock that was. This may be because of the study that was done where it was projected that camera sales of fixed-lens cameras will be down significantly in double digits. The cancellation of the DL series as well as the stagnation of the 1 series means that Nikon will have to rely more on ever on DSLR sales. In other words, their regular digital single-lens reflex mirror camera sales. Much like Canon, the company is lagging behind Sony and Fujifilm in the mirrorless section of the camera market, though it did launch a lineup of action cameras in 2016. Nikon's latest attempt to compete in the popular luxury compact category, dominated by Sony's RX100. Everyone was expecting delivery late last year, never came, and now the cancellation. Hey, you know, the Super Bowl at halftime, I was watching it the other day, and what happened was that I thought that was a presentation with Lady Gaga singing, and you had these 300 to 500 drones flying in the back. But it turns out that was not real, or at least that was not real time. They had pre-recorded it, and the reason why it was not done live is that the FAA bans the flight of these devices flying overhead during an event like the Super Bowl. And what made it even more fascinating was that the 300 to 500 drones that were used was pre-recorded, and none of them communicated with each other. Instead, they were guided by a person who programmed it to be guided by the GPS that they were connecting with. And now, can you imagine programming a couple hundred drones to fly in formation? Wow. That's very impressive. Now, these drones were no more than 8 ounces in weight, and they were 1 square foot in size. I'm very impressed with that. IBM is forcing more than just its U.S. marketing staff to move to a handful of regional hubs. The crackdown on remote workers and small offices also hits engineers and other staffers in America and Europe. Following the report that Big Blue was demanding marketers to work at one of 6 strategic U.S. locations, locations chosen for them by IBM, the sources said the move or leave program has been and will continue to be applied throughout the tech giant, and with at least one other department already implementing the new rules. According to well-placed sources, IBM Software and Systems unit began a transition similar to the marketing department upheaval late last year, with remote workers told they would have to move and work at one of a handful of city offices or find a new job. Yesterday, IBM U.S. marketing employees were told they must report to and work at one of these main offices in America: New York, San Francisco, Austin, Cambridge, Atlanta, or Raleigh. Teams in the software and systems division will also be made to work at those hubs, though told that IBM is keeping some of its labs open, and software and system employees may be able to be relocated to one of those. The consolidation effort, which IBM is pitching as a move to improve productivity, teamwork, and morale, is set to be extended to all IBM operations over the next 6 months. Remote workers and staff at small offices will be told to move closer to a regional hub, and IBM is offering to cover some costs or leave the company. Employees are given roughly 30 days to make up their mind what they want to do. This policy is also being extended to operations in Europe. Staffers in the UK and the continent will be expected to show up at main offices with telecommuting ban. IBM has pitched all this change to employees as a way to improve working environment and office culture in a video message to staff. There's something about a team being more powerful, more impactful, more creative, and frankly, as what they say, hopefully having more fun when they are shoulder to shoulder working together with each other. However, within the IBM rank and file, the move is seen as more of an excuse to cut a portion of the workforce, and in particular, one specific portion. Multiple sources believe that the move will be disproportionately affected with older workers who have already put down roots with a home and family in a specific area. This decision is to move people across the country might be by design to cut loose older and more expensive workers. By requiring that workers move to a hub city such as San Francisco, Austin, or New York, IBM could both rid itself of older workers and make the jobs more appealing to younger, lower-salaried professionals. Coincidentally, an intended IBM video distributed staff that advocates working in an office is more fun. It features a lot of young people who wouldn't dream of telecommuting. My, my, my. At one time, you were able to work at home, and now they want you to come back into the office because it's more productive.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Okay, I'm back again, and today I want to talk about sensors. I've got a couple different stories about sensors that I'd like to cover. But first, before I start, let me just ask you a question. How are you feeling today? Well, scientists at MIT think that they can tell the answer to that. They've taken information from wearable devices, wristbands, and such that can measure physiological measurements like heartbeat and breathing rate and blood pressure, things like that. And then they've also had devices listen to spoken conversation. They're not analyzing the words that were said, but they're just listening to the tone, the pacing, the pitch of the voice, and throwing all this together in a big data soup. And they believe that they can identify whether the subject is in a positive or negative mood at that point. Now, it's just, I'm happy or not happy. They don't get into finer emotions, angry, scared, sad, depressed, whatever. It's just positive or negative. But still, it's a start. And in their study, they discovered that their system is more than 7% more accurate at correctly identifying the subject's mood than the standard subjective methods that are currently used. It's an interesting technology, and it does have practical applications. For healthcare workers, it can be very important when they're working with patients who have problems communicating. If they can tell that the patient is not in a good mood for whatever reason, if they can find that out early before the patient gets frustrated and angry and acting out, it could help them diffuse situations and address problems before they blossom into something much bigger and much more of a problem. So the next time somebody asks you, how are you feeling today? Don't be surprised if maybe your smartwatch already knows the answer. Another sensor story is about basic physiological kinds of measurements, some of the biometrics that we're interested in, like blood pressure, heartbeat rate, different chemical levels in the body, things like that. So far, a lot of companies have taken a route of using optical sensors. Now, in this approach, you'll have LEDs that emit light. Typically, they'll have LEDs that emit different colors light so that they can compare the results. And then they have optical sensors that measure the amount of light that's being reflected back from the skin and the tissues below the skin. Makes some sense. I mean, obviously, the oxygenated blood is red. Blood in the veins that doesn't have oxygen in it is bluer. You can see how you can distinguish the amount of oxygen in the blood, perhaps by the color that's sensed. However, these optical sensors and wearables have a lot of problems. One of the issues is the sensor has to be in tight contact with the skin. If there's a gap there, ambient light could leak in. You can get incorrect readings. That's a problem, and not everybody wants to have a wristband that's cinched down tight on their wrist. Another problem is that different things can throw off the results. Apple Watch is a perfect example. Apple had to send out an announcement warning people that the optical sensors may not be accurate if, for example, you have tattoos on your wrist where the sensors are located. The color of the tattoo ink can affect the results. Even the pigmentation of your skin can cause problems with the results. And finally, LEDs, they're very efficient compared to incandescent lights, but they still consume a fair amount of energy to create light. This is why some of the devices only take measurements intermittently. For example, we'll measure your heartbeat every once in a while, but not constantly. There's a Canadian company called BioMinder. It's spelled B-I-O-M-I-N-D-R, BioMinder. And they think they've got a better way of doing this. Instead of using optical sensors, they use radio frequency sensors. So they have little chips. Right now, it's a two-chip design. One chip will emit radio frequency waves, and the other chip receives them. But they have a future design in the works where it'll be a single chip that's a transceiver, does the transmitting and receiving all in one tiny little chip. The company says one of the advantages of this approach is that the device doesn't have to be in direct contact with the skin. This is a big advantage. For example, it means that the sensors could be put into smart clothing, put into a shirt or pants or whatever, could still accurately measure the biometric measures that you're interested in. It's interesting that the company claims that it can measure more than just the heart rate. They also can measure hydration level. They can measure the level of sodium, which is something that can be important to athletes. And the company also claims that their device can even measure blood sugar levels. They can measure the glucose level in the subject's body. If it's true, it could be very useful and very interesting since it could replace the finger stick that diabetics have to use to measure their blood sugar levels throughout the day. The company has tested their device, and they say that test results show that their measurements are equivalent to those that are produced by standard blood tests. So it'd be interesting to see how this technology develops. Hopefully some wearable manufacturers will license this technology and we'll see it showing up in new devices soon. Do you know what pectin is? It's a natural material and it's found in apples and other fruits. It's actually the chemical that makes jelly gel. It's the chemical that causes it to be thick. Caltech researchers have been working with this material and they've discovered it's got a very interesting property. Its electrical characteristics change in a very predictable and very measurable way as temperature changes. So it turns out to be a very effective temperature sensor. Now they've managed to take this material and create very thin, flexible films out of it that could be used as an artificial skin that can also measure temperature. This could be very helpful because one of the problems with many patients is that they may have an infection that can turn into a real serious problem. By measuring the temperature of the body in different locations, it's possible to detect small temperature changes early, which would be a sign of inflammation and increased blood flow around that infection. And this could help head off infection problems before they become a bigger issue and possibly even life-threatening. This skin is much more accurate than the other artificial skins are in terms of measuring temperature by a factor of 10 times or more. So it's pretty significant. This could also be used for putting on prosthetic limbs to provide feedback to the wearer about temperature changes as well. So it's an interesting new technology that has a lot of applications and could play a role in improving the lives of lots of people. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. I have another item that I want to talk about, Joe, and I was very surprised by this. According to the United States Justice Department now, this is not the FBI, but the Justice Department, they are saying that there is 4,000 cases of ransomware a day. Could you believe that? A day.
Those are not per day. Those are not being qualified or quantified. So is it a threat that was never applied? Was it something by error? Was it a hacker? Was it real ransomware? They're all lumped together. Again, very often the statistics that you get are questionable and you need the source. And in this, like so many other government cases, you're not being given the source information. But nevertheless, the whole question of ransomware, I think, is a very important one. You were telling me about a hotel situation.
Right, in Austria. By the way, let me just say that whatever is reported is always the tip of the iceberg because a lot of the stuff is unreported. We're not going to get into that. What happened was that in Austria, there's a famous hotel for the rich and famous, and they have an automated lock key system, and someone... Right. And what happened in this Austrian hotel was someone broke into the system and locked everyone out. And people who had their valuables in there, 180 rich customers couldn't get to their personal items. And now, one of the things they could have done, which would have been very expensive, was because, you know, this is a luxury hotel, was to break down every door. Well, it appears that they paid it in Bitcoin in terms of ransom, And they said that one of the things that they are looking into very seriously is changing that type of lock to regular lock and key physically. Remember the show we did about a couple weeks ago, Joe, on IoT, the Internet of Things?
Yes, that's really what we're all talking about.
There's no security at all. And by the way, one of the things that the Justice Department and the FBI is saying is that paying ransom does not guarantee that it will be unlocked. And they recommend you don't do it. But well, if they if all governments stop the use of Bitcoin or acceptance of it or processing of it, that may stop it.
I got a better one for you.
What's that?
Suppose we tell everybody that smoking is dangerous and nobody will smoke after that, right?
Yes and no. Let me talk about that, okay? You know, back in the 1960s, with the Surgeon General, adult smoking was about 34 to 38%, and they say now that adult smoking is down to 16%. And they say, isn't that great? Well, the reason why it dropped down to 16% is many people have died from it, and yet the tobacco. And the tobacco companies are still making money, and you know how they do it? They export it to Asia, to around the world. No, it's not at all. Now, wait, Joe. You remember now? You were in the service, okay? And you were getting cigarettes cheap, or if not for free. And the big ad was 7 out of 10 doctors recommend Chesterfield.
Old
Gold, Lucky Strikes. I agree with you on that. it was announced that we talked about Link NYC. Link NYC is what they have these.
Yes, it's come to my neighborhood.
Okay, you have these 9-foot monoliths that offer Wi-Fi, very high speed, and of course they had problems with the content, and they've since limited what content you can access and so on. And there's 7,500 telephone booths that were wired for regular telephone, and they've converted 600 out of 7,500. But I was amazed they announced that of the 600 units that are already installed, which is mainly in Manhattan, they have over 1.5 million subscribers.
I don't know what they mean by a subscriber, because
you've signed on.
I can sign on as I walk by, but it's not a subscription. It's just the same way I would sign on to any open.
Well, they don't call it subscription. They mean basically unique users.
And here's the thing. It's a tremendous benefit in two different ways. One, it's got two USB outlets on it, on each tower. And you can use those to charge your phone. It's a high-speed charge if your phone is able to receive a high-speed charge. So, for example, on my phone, I can just stand there for 15 minutes and get enough charge on my phone to last another 6 hours or 7 hours. The other thing I can do is I can use it to call 911 for an emergency without any phone, without plugging anything in.
You can call the fire department, too.
Yeah, it's a speaker phone for the 911 and the fire department. The other thing is it's got a monitor built in so that you can, or some of them do, not all of them, so that you can actually access the web and see the weather, the news, what have you. What you were referring to earlier about content was in certain neighborhoods in Manhattan, they found that people were bringing up a folding chair or a folding stool and sitting next to it and tuning into pornography on the internet.
That is not what it was meant to do, but they've since eliminated that.
Yes, they've eliminated that capability. But they've still given us the capability of wireless. And there are not too many, but I found a couple of where there were benches nearby, and I could sign on and do my email or whatnot, you know, from 10 or 15 feet away on a bench. There is one within distance of a pocket park, but I found that the signal didn't go far enough for that.
But remember one important thing. There's no security. I mean, there is security, but I don't trust it. It's wireless. Just remember that.
Let me throw out something. I ran it by one of our built-in experts on such things, and he disapproved of it. Nevertheless, I do use it occasionally. The Opera browser now has built-in VPN for you. They've taken over a company that used to offer a free VPN, and they now have built it into their Opera browser so that you can activate the VPN on a touch of a button.
Yes, that's true. By the way, Joe, I maybe I'm old-fashioned, okay? But when it comes to any transactional thing I want to do, such as buying something online, banking, paying bills, I use wire connection to the internet. I do not use wireless, even though I have wireless at home, period. I don't use it. I don't do transactional processing wireless.
Well, again, as I say, if you have a virtual private network, a VPN, you're probably relatively safe. I would not advise people to do it or not do it. I'm not sure. I will say this. I have used my internal wireless network using VPN on it here at home to buy things from Amazon. But I check my Amazon bill very, very carefully each month, and so far I've had no problems.
Public service announcements. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be having a meeting on Thursday, February the 23rd at 6:45 p.m., and the topic of presentation is how to purchase and maintain the correct printing equipment. It will be held at the Middletown Library in Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group next meeting will be held on Tuesday, February the 28th at 7 p.m., and their presentation is Partitioning a Hard Drive on Your Windows Computer, and it will be held at Mercer County Library, located in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will meet on Thursday, March the 2nd at 7 p.m. Presentation is Memory Development, and it will be held at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, located at White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on Polyglot Build 2s, Friday, March the 3rd, 8 p.m., and it will be held at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on photobooks, the compact way of storing memories, Tuesday, March the 7th, at the Community Room at the Computer Learning Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road, and their phone number is 609-883-1776. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be having their meeting on Thursday, March the 9th, 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in New York, and photo ID is required. And finally, TCF 2017, formerly known as the Trenton Computer Festival, will be held on Saturday, March the 18th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the theme of the festival will be autonomous vehicles. There'll be talks, workshops, vendors, and there'll be a banquet afterwards at the College of New Jersey. For more information, tcf-nj.org. And I hope to be there, and I hope to see you.
Hey, Joe Rajewski here. It's time for Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Busy people like you. Here's a simple, cool computer tip you need to know. Now, let me forewarn you that you're probably going to do what I did. Dismiss this tip as something not worth memorizing. Until the next time you mistakenly close a web browser tab for a website with important information, then oh, how you'll celebrate with song and dance the day you learn this tip, because you'll know exactly what to do. Now, if you close a tab by mistake, all you need to do is press Control-Shift-T for Windows or Command-Shift-T for Mac. Now, that may sound complicated, but the T part is easy to remember because the word tab begins with the letter T. Give it a shot. Just close an unimportant tab in your web browser, press Control-Shift-T, Windows, or Command-Shift-T, Mac, and then be amazed by its spectacular return. Try this tip now and you'll never forget it. And that's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. You can check out more great tips for non-techies in my new book. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rajewski, over and out.
Thank you, Joe. And now we have Home Automation by Marty Winston.
A lot of you know that I've been working on an ultra-automated, energy-miserly, 40-year maintenance-free house. 40yearhouse.com has more on that. And I was doing some homework about that this week that will interest some of you. Being that this is PRN, I'm going to limit it here to septic systems. If you pay a sewer bill, you're not on a septic system. But if you're on a septic system, there are a couple of things you can do to extend the time that it's viable without needing to pay it all the money to get things replaced or remediated or any of that stuff. And it has to do with some fairly simple things that you don't put in it. And it's that simple. One of the things that surprised me was salt. And the subject that came up was, does a house have a water softener? Well, yeah, it does. Is it salt-based? Yes. So it produces brine. Yes, it produces brine. When you produce brine during the regeneration cycle of a water softener, that brine's very salty. And salt put into the septic tank water, where most of us would send it, will ultimately cause or help or promote salt caking on the tank. Now, sometimes that takes a while and doesn't make a difference. Sometimes it happens a lot faster than you think it would. And since We're building a house for essentially lazy cheapskates, people who don't want to have to do chores and don't want to have to have chores happen or bills happen if they can be delayed. This is something that really grabs my attention. Okay, what do I do with the brine if I don't send it to the septic system? It's going to kill the lawn. So what you do is echo the tail end part of the septic system. You dig a hole in the yard not far from the foundation of the house. And deep in that hole, you lay rocks and then gravel and cinders and similar stuff. And you send the little hose or a little hose out from the regeneration port on the softener where it's going to send it anyway. Normally that just goes down a sewer. And instead you send it into this essentially garbage can size filter that lets the water go into there. The salt will cake on the stones. The salt doesn't get into the kinds of dirt that are enriching your lawn or your plantings. And you've solved that salt problem without having it accelerate a septic system bill. Well, something else also came up. When a septic system fails, and septic systems work a lot like your tummy works. It's a digestive process. It uses microbes, bacteria, to eat stuff that you want to be done with, gone with. And then that goes and floats down a pipe to a drain field, and it goes out the drain field, except sometimes it doesn't. What happens is that if too much water comes into the tank, water, H2O, remember that stuff, water. If too much water comes into the tank, it starts floating stuff out of the tank prematurely, and that stuff can go down the pipes, coat the pipes, and especially coat some of the places in the drain field where the pipes are supposed to be letting the drained effluent out into the soil. You start plugging that up and you've got the beginnings of backing up a system. You back up a system, you could have a very expensive group of unexpected bills facing you. So taking water that's there in quantity, and I'm not talking about flushing toilets, that's got to go there. And I'm not talking about shower water, that's got to go there. But if you're doing other things with large quantities of water, I'm going to give you one in a second that will surprise you. Don't put it in the septic system. Put it somewhere else, like that underground gravel pit. In this case, I mentioned that this house has a 90 pint per day. That's the maximum, 90 pint per day dehumidifier. And in South Carolina, where it's located, it's going to need a lot of dehumidification. So by taking that pipe as well, taking it to the same place as the regeneration brine, putting it down in, first of all, I'm thinning out the brine, which is helpful. And second, and you know, that's a place where more water is good, but I'm not letting more water go into the septic tank. Now, there are some commercial products out there that are very good at encouraging, it's kind of like probiotics for you. It's the same thing for the septic tank, where they're adding billions and billions of bacteria, and those billions of bacteria do help more complete digestion happens. The more complete the digestion, the less sludge is left in the tank. And the less sludge, the less cleanout, because every time that tank needs to get pumped out, to get cleaned out, you're taking away a lot of bacterial growth, and it's going to take 10 months for that to restore. And the extent to which it doesn't restore, the extent to which digestion is less than thorough, is the extent to which you may be sending more than you wanted down to the drain field where it can end up costing you money. So we're going to try to stop loss here. And we're stopping loss by saying the once a month bacteria booster treatments end up costing you about $4 a month. They're a good thing to do, and do it once a month. Do it the way it says. No matter how new or old your system is, get that going. Now, the other thing we're doing, the particular tank we have, is getting a booster aeration pump from Biomicrobics. This has a fountain mechanism inside the tank where people will never go once it's installed. It'll be down there, and it puts bubbles. It oxygenates the water. It makes a fountain and comes back down into kind of like a cultivating area. In addition to the standard anaerobic, no oxygen, anaerobic bacteria that normally grow there and do the digestion, It grows aerobic bacteria, which are larger and more aggressive, and give the anaerobic bacteria a head start. Now, but that's a lot more than you ever wanted to know about bacteria in or out of a septic tank. But let's deal with this in a 1, 2, 3 kind of logical fashion. One, if you've got a septic tank, if you're not getting a sewer bill. Two, if you don't want to pay any extra charges for solving things that did not need to be broken in the first place. Then three, follow the advice of not letting water softener brine go in there, not letting dehumidifier output go in there, probably not letting the runoff from your gutters go in there either. Keep the water out, adding bacteria, and if you can afford an aeration system, it also helps all of the same stuff happen. So that's all we wanted to say about septic. And again, being PRN, you're going to, these words are going to reach many listeners who are not based in urban environments, many who do not get that sewer bill. Well, it's time to take my mind out of the sewer. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay warm. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.